And tonight we're with Mark Goodman as we talk about future crime, cyber crime, and technology. And we'll join in with your calls next hour, of course, on Coast to Coast AM as well. Mark Goodman with us. Mark, I think most of us have received the Nigerian scam email asking for us to, you know, get a bank account set up and stuff. How many people fall for that thing?
It sounds like a pretty good deal. You should do it.
No, I'll rush right out and do it.
Yeah, exactly. So here's an important listener safety tip. There is no prince in Nigeria that knows you. Okay, you have not been selected individually by a prince to help him exfiltrate his millions of dollars out of Lagos. And tens of thousands of people fall for it every year. Remember, in the last hour we were talking about criminals being early adopters. Do you know that those letters used to actually arrive by post, and then when the fax machine came along, they were a boon to those what are called 419 scammers or the Nigerian West African fraud scammers. And, of course, now it's all on email. But they are incredibly sophisticated in terms of how they do that and how they carry it out, and they're very, very convincing. It's brilliant social engineering.
But what do they ask for with those? I never followed through, obviously.
Oh, so what happens is they'll send you a note and say, hello, I am the Right Honorable, you know, so-and-so. I am a member of Parliament, or I'm part of the opposition government, and I have a fortune of $35 million that I'm trying to get out of the country because they're seizing my assets. And I've selected you based upon the recommendation of one of your friends because you're a very trustworthy individual. And if you go ahead and help me move this money out, I will pay you 10% of the fee. And you think, wow, $3.5 million, that's huge. And then they'll take you through and they'll keep talking to you and keep talking to you. And eventually what they say is, now, in order for me to be able to do this, to get my $35 million out, I need to take a bus ride to the other part of the country. And can you send me bus money? But don't worry, your $3.5 million is coming. And then they'll say, okay, well, before I send you this $3.5 million, I need you to put up some good faith money. How do I know that I can really trust you? So send me $20,000 and the $300 million will be coming your way. And people fall for it all the time.
No, you've got to be kidding me, Mark. They do, and they wire the money?
They wire the money, and it's really sophisticated. Years ago when I was working with Interpol, they had a case which was quite brilliant, and this goes back to Kevin Mitnick and social engineering that we were talking about. But they had this elderly gentleman from the UK, a pensioner, who they convinced to send basically his life savings and to get the last bit of money. This guy claimed to be the sitting Nigerian oil minister. And in order to get out his last bit of life savings, which was, you know, $1,000, they invited him to Nigeria to meet the minister. And it was like a scene from a movie. When he arrived, he showed up.
They actually got him to come.
Yeah, they got him to come because he thought he was being smart. He said, I don't know, this sounds shady. I'm not going to send you any more money until I get to check this out myself. So he bought a ticket from London to Lagos, flew over there. He was met by the minister's security detail, who picked him up. They put him in the oil minister's limousine with the two Nigerian flags.
All right, and this is for real? The real oil minister?
This happened. This was a case that we had. They drove him to the Ministry of Energy, or oil, in Lagos. The guards saluted when the limousine came through. They took him up to the minister's office. They met him. He had pictures of the president and the Nigerian flags on the top floor in the minister's office. And he left convinced, okay, this is legitimate. He flew home and spent the money. What he didn't know is that the actual oil minister was out of the country at the time. The rest of it was a big scam. They rented a Mercedes. They put the flags on the door. They put off the guard at the ministry. They even substituted the official portrait in the minister's office to be their, you know, criminal schnook who played the role of the minister.
Amazing.
And the whole thing was a scam. So they go through tremendous, you know, expense to make this.
How much do you think they get and they raise with their scam?
Oh, I mean, it's tens of millions of dollars a year.
It's a big business then.
It is. And it's just one of many, many scams. It's called advanced fee fraud. And again, the internet makes this really, really easy. And there are so many different ways of doing it. It can all be automated. You know, there are these things called the Yahoo Boys, is what they're known as. And there's actually even been a documentary on it, whose job it is, and I mean like job, to sit at cyber cafes in West Africa and just pump out these messages 24/7, engaging with people. They have a variety of different scams. Sometimes they'll pretend to be a lover, right? So, yes, you know, they'll prey on single women often, and they'll pretend, you know, oh, I'm so in love with you. I'd love to come to visit you in America. Please send me a ticket. Please send me money. Lots of different scams out there. This comes down to one of the fundamental points that I mentioned in Future Crime, is that we live in a world which is in screen we trust, right? I say joking.
In screen we trust. We also, is it greed? What is it that motivates the person to send the money?
Yeah, well, it's definitely greed. Avarice plays a role in this. The thought that, wow, I can get rich quick. And, you know, anybody with sense knows that these get-rich-quick schemes don't work. But it's also easy to trick people. That's why I say it's in screen we trust. If you got a text message that popped up that said it was from your wife or your mom or, you know, your college buddy, and it said, message from Joe or message from mom, how would you know it wasn't from mom, right?
Well,
how would you know?
You know, I'm in a small circle when it comes to stuff like that.
Okay.
So so I'd be able to check that out pretty fast.
You could check it out, but if it was just something totally innocuous, like I'm running 5 minutes late, I mean, that's some of the problems with these attackers, is that they will sit in your network and watch what you're doing for a long time and figure out how you act, what you say, how mm-hmm. you say it, and then repeat it so it seems legitimate. We were talking earlier about that banking scam that was reported in the New York Times worth $300 million, where now it looks like $1 billion worth lost. They studied the bank employees. They knew how they talk. So the fact is we don't really have any trustworthy computing. Like if you type in Amazon.com, how do you know you're actually going to Amazon?
You don't.
Right?
You don't.
You don't. It looks like Amazon. And so that's how these phishing scams work. They send you an email, it looks like it comes from Bank of America or Chase Manhattan, and it says, oh, your account is overdrawn, please click here, or, you know, you need to change your password, please click here. And that's kind of another one of these modern fraud schemes. People fall for it all the time. They click on the link, they download a virus on their computer, and now, once they put in their actual banking information, the bad guys have access to their account. So we really don't have trustworthy computing.
So you have to click on the link, though, to get the virus? They haven't developed a way yet to get you the minute they send it, right?
Unfortunately, that's not true. There's a whole new field of research, if you want to call it that, on the part of the bad guys, and it's called drive-by downloads. Yahoo actually fell victim to this. So the standard way, and the way that we've been taught to kind of protect ourselves, is watch what links you click on and don't download things, don't click on attachments and downloads if you don't know who they came from. But now they've actually created drive-by downloads. And as I mentioned, this happened to Yahoo. So if you went to the Yahoo homepage or visited Yahoo Sports section, Yahoo Finance, you know all those pop-up ads that we see and all the embedded ads on the webpage? They were actually able to manipulate the Java code. So if you had an outdated version of Java computer script running on your computer, just by visiting Yahoo's homepage, you could have been subjected to an attack.
These people are brilliant, Mark.
They put a lot of time, energy, and effort into this. Well, think about the money involved, right? You take a corporation like Apple or GM or Ford. Why does everybody show up at work? Why are they listed on the stock exchange? Because they make money. Criminals make money doing this. There was a report out from McAfee about, I guess, 10 months ago now. They said that the global cost of cybercrime, on an annual basis, is $400 billion. $400 billion. Now, there are lots of studies out there. Some of them are quite bogus, but this was a really serious study. It was done in concert with the Washington think tank. And so the numbers are huge. And it's not just hackers, right? There are other forms of criminal enterprises, too. I'm not sure if you heard about the Silk Road trial that occurred.
Yeah,
recently.
Absolutely.
So in that case, a kid set up a website on the dark web, the sort of digital underground.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about the dark web in a second. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. So, you know, we all think that we know the Internet. Most good people, they'll go to ESPN.com, they'll go to Google, they'll be on Facebook, and they think, wow, I'm on the Internet. But what they don't realize is that that's technically only the surface web. It is a very small percentage of the information that is out there in the world. There's this whole other world of data hidden behind passwords and firewalls and private databases, and some of that is criminal information. And it turns out that that deep web is 500 times larger than the surface web. So if you think about a database like LexisNexis, it's a private database. You have to pay subscription, you know, legal databases. All that data added up is 500 times bigger than the surface web. So when you're searching Google, you're actually searching a much smaller percentage of the internet than you realize. Google only indexes about 16% of the surface web. That was according to a study in Nature magazine. So when you're searching Google, you're only getting 16% of the available surface web data, and you're missing all of the data from the deep web, that part of the web where you need a password or a secret code to get in. So overall, Google is only indexing 0.03% of the available information, digital information on our planet. So we think we have access to everything, but there's mountains of stuff that we're missing. And within that world, within the deep web, is a subsection known as the dark web or the secret web. And this is where criminals ply their trade. This is where you can buy any type of illicit drug you want, stolen passports, credit cards, hacker tools, malware, child pornography. It's all out there and available on the dark web. And people require a special piece of software to access it. It's called Tor, or the Onion Router. And there's lots of legitimate reasons, actually, for having Tor. Tor, believe it or not, was actually developed by the U.S. government, the Department of Navy.
And what is Tor?
Tor is a special software that you can run on your computer. So Tor stands for the Onion Router. And it's a special program, so the same way you could download an app on your phone, or you can download Microsoft Windows or Microsoft Word. The Tor is a piece of software. It was created by the U.S. government, and it was originally created to encrypt communications and to bypass national firewalls. So the State Department and the Navy were trying to help democracy and human rights activists overseas in places like China, Iran, Syria, where they have Russia, where they have so these repressive regimes and are very hard and kill human rights activists. And what they were trying to do is come up with a way for them to have private communications so they could, you know, do their democracy work and actually get access to the outside world. It was a great idea, but of course criminals always ever ready took advantage of this tool. And so while there are legitimate reasons for Tor, and there are millions of downloads every year of it, now criminals have subverted it, and they've created a subsection of the deep web known as the dark web. And you need the Tor browser, the Tor onion router. So it's a special type of browser.
Why do you call it an onion router? Because of the layers within it?
Yeah, exactly correct. So you peel back the onion to get access to it. And remember what I said before, you think you're on the internet, but you're only on a tiny subsection of it. What they do through this is they peel back the onion and allow you to get into that network.
The Navy used to use this.
The Navy created it. The Navy actually created it for democracy activists overseas. And it's still one of the prime ways that people in China can read Facebook and the BBC and the like. But within this, because that's all blocked at the national firewall level that they have running in China, the Great Firewall, as they call it. But now criminals can use it too. And so there was a criminal who created basically an Amazon.com or an eBay for drugs. And it was called the Silk Road, and you needed the Tor browser or the Onion Router to get access to it. And, of course, the drug dealers benefit from that encryption because it makes them nearly impossible to trace, hard to figure out who's doing what, because the Onion Router bounces your traffic around. So we've all, your internet traffic, we've all seen those scenes in movies where the bad guy's calling the cops or the victim, and, you know, they'll bounce.
They'll try to catch him, and they can't get
him. But they'll route the call through Chicago and Seattle and Austin, Texas first. Well, that's what the Onion Router does. It mixes and matches your internet traffic with thousands of other people, bounces it all over the world, and makes it hard for people to trace you.
Now, is this good or bad?
Well, it's great if you're a democracy activist in China trying to get access to the world. If you're, you know, under a repressive regime in Iran, then this gives you access to the world, to information, and so you really can get word out of what's going on inside the country, which was the U.S. government's hope and why they created it. But as I said, like all technological tools, it was commandeered by bad guys. And so the Silk Road was a place where people would access it via Tor, and they would use it to sell cocaine, heroin, 5 kilos, 10 kilos. You could buy Uzis, AK-47s, silencers, child pornography. And it turns out that the Silk Road was in business for just over 2.5 years. The Silk Road was founded by a kid called Ross Ulbricht. He was 28 years old and a smart kid. He was an Eagle Scout, went to the University of Texas, had a master's degree from Carnegie Mellon. And so rather, you know, than using those skills for some more positive purpose, he created the Silk Road. The FBI eventually figured it out, which is a fascinating story in and of itself. But for years, it operated in obscurity, and people moved tons of drugs. The FBI, when they eventually caught up with Ross Ulbricht, the kid who launched the Silk Road, they estimated, looking at the transactions, that they moved $1.2 billion of illicit goods in just 2.5 years. $1.2 billion of child pornography, you know, illicit firearms, silencers, child porn, all of that stuff transited the Silk Road. You could even buy a hitman on the Silk Road. So you could contract with a hitman, pay him in Bitcoin, and do the whole transaction through the Silk Road. And because it operated like eBay, that meant that the house got a cut of every deal. So that $1.2 billion, this 20-year-old kid called Ross Ulbricht, his personal net worth at the end of that was $110 million. So there's huge amounts of money to be made here. And I used to talk about the alleged operator of the Silk Road, but just about 10 or 14 days ago, Ross Ulbricht was convicted of all the counts against him in court.
Huh. It wasn't worth it then, was it?
Well, you know, it's worth it until you're caught.
He lived well.
He lived well. Actually, he lived very plainly, believe it or not. He just kept all the money in Bitcoin in his bank, and I'm sure he had an escape plan, but the law caught up with him first. I joke in Future Crimes, you know, we all hear that crime doesn't pay. But crime doesn't pay once you're caught. But until you're caught, it pays pretty well. El Chapo, Joaquin Guzman, who ran the Sinaloa cartel down in Mexico, drug dealer, when he was finally arrested, he had in his basement $200 million in cash on hand, in cash, sitting in his basement. To put that amount in perspective, Interpol's annual budget, operating in 192 countries around the world, is only $90 million. So just one dealer in Mexico had more than double Interpol's annual budget of cash on hand.
So the kid's going to get sentenced in May, and seven charges. He could get life in prison for all of this.
Very much so. And it's not just the drug dealing. One of the crazy things about this case is he was actually convicted of solicitation for homicide. What happened? The Silk Road grew so large that he actually needed help to run the website. So he put out an ad and found a system administrator to help him run the site. And his system administrator, he found out, was actually stealing from him. He was paying the guy a really small amount, you know, $50,000 a year. And the system administrator looked at the hundreds of millions of dollars that were going across the site and started to, you know, realize, hey, I should be getting paid way more. So he started to embezzle from this guy, Ross Ulbricht, who found out about it and got really mad. And so he hired a hitman on his own website on the encrypted underground Silk Road. He looked in the directory of services and found a hitman. And under a hitman, he hired a guy. And the guy said, sure, I'll kill the system administrator for you. It'll be $40,000 payable in Bitcoin. Jeez. And he said, great, but I want proof of death, is what Ross Ulbricht was allegedly
like his ear or head or something. Huh?
Exactly. And so he said, no problem. He paid the first $40,000, and then 2 weeks later, he got a photograph of the system administrator that worked for him, dead on the ground with his brains blown out in a pile of blood. And then he wired the second amount of money in Bitcoin to the assassin, paid $80,000 total. And what was very revealing is, in his discussions with the assassin, he said, you know, I really didn't want to have to kill the guy, but he stole from me, and so I had to send him a message. And then Ross Ulbricht complained to the assassin, you know, that's the problem with people today. They just don't have any integrity. So the guy, who is one of the largest drug dealers in the world, you know, just ordered a hit on his own employee, was complaining about the integrity of others. What he didn't realize is that hitman was actually an undercover FBI agent. By the time that he ordered the hit, he was actually communicating with the FBI, and the FBI, once they saw how serious this kid was, they knocked on the door of the system administrator, his co-conspirator, and said, hey, we're with the FBI. We know you're running the Silk Road, and by the way, your boss just put out a hit on you.
Jeez, let's talk more about that, Mark, when we come right back. Well, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with Mark Goodman as we talk about future crimes. Also, if you've been a victim of some kind of hack, share that story with us as well. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast, Mark Goodman with us as we talk about his work and his book, Future Crimes. Mark, back to Silk Road for a moment. What were they doing that was illegal? I mean, were they selling drugs? What did they do that really got them in trouble?
Well, it's actually a really interesting question. And the conviction was up in the air for a while, or the prosecution, because they didn't really sell drugs. They created the marketplace that sold the drugs. And so what they were saying is, hey, we didn't sell drugs, we didn't sell guns, all we did was create a website. And so that was their defense. And of course, the federal government came in and charged them with a bunch of conspiracy and trafficking and other drugs-related offenses. Obviously, they didn't declare the tax money and things like that. So the same way, you know, they go after the gangsters, usually they can. There's a whole bunch of statutes available to them that they can use. I did want to finish up how the FBI convinced Ross Ulbricht of the murder, if I can.
Yeah, please.
Just because I think they'd find your listeners might find it interesting. So after they knocked on the door of the system administrator, they convinced him to cooperate because they told him there was a hit out on his life. The FBI actually got in a Hollywood makeup artist and put white pancake on his face and fake blood all over the ground.
Oh, jeez.
That they sent to Ross Ulbricht to convince him that his system administrator was dead, and that's why he paid the second half of the $40,000. So, you know, he seemed like a nice kid. He was an Eagle Scout, had a master's degree, but when push came to shove, he had no problems committing homicide, of which he was convicted. That was one of the other charges, not committing homicide, but solicitation to commit homicide.
How did Silk Road grow so fast? I mean, how do people know about this stuff?
So there's a very vibrant, you know, underground on the internet. In the same way, you know, if you are a drug user, you know where to score drugs, right? If you said to, you know, the average decent person, go figure out where you're going to go get 2 kilos of cocaine, they probably wouldn't know where to go. But if you if you're a drug user, a user of illicit drugs, then you certainly know the places where to go and where to get it. And the same is true on the internet.
That's amazing how they do this. It's like a network of underground people, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's massive, and it's global, and it's multilingual, and it runs like any other company. So, again, the fact is you want a Norwegian passport, you want a Ugandan diplomat's passport, you can get that online. There's a whole section on counterfeiting where you'll pay anywhere from 10 to 30 cents on a dollar for, you know, $100,000 of counterfeit U.S. notes or Japanese yen or euros. So there is just a very vibrant marketplace, and it's all moved online.
What do you find right now, Mark, as the biggest problem for America with hacking? Is it taking down the power grid? What is it?
So in terms of our vulnerabilities in the United States and in every modern country, we have critical infrastructures. Those are the systems upon which we depend to have our modern society function. So it's the electrical grid, it is the water treatment facilities, it's sewage plants, it's ATMs, the financial networks, air traffic control, 911. All of those systems are dependent upon computers, right? You don't do air traffic control without computers. You don't do water treatment without computers. You can't manage the electricity grid without computers. And the problem is that these industrial control systems are entirely hackable. There has never been built yet a computer system that could not be hacked. And yet, day after day, we keep on connecting the most fundamental and important systems of our society to computers. And so I think that that is a very big problem. Because we're one of the most technologically advanced societies out there, if this infrastructure comes under attack, we'll have the most to lose, right? There are many societies where they don't have power, they don't have electricity as part of their daily lives. But we do, and we're highly dependent on it. You know, in Los Angeles, when I was a police officer, we had several large earthquakes, and we lost power. And one of the things you realize very quickly when you lose power for hours or days is that you lose a lot. So you couldn't go to the ATM and take money out. If your car was parked in a garage, you know, in an apartment building, you couldn't get your car out. If you went to McDonald's with cash, they couldn't ring up your quarter pounder because they couldn't make the registers work. So society kind of stopped when that happens. And so the biggest threat that I see here to America is that we're not taking these threats seriously. You know, you mentioned the Sony hack earlier. And after that attack started in November of 2014, that it came out in the press, President Obama got involved in it quite early on. And he said, oh, we're going to deal with this. We're going to deal with North Korea. We're going to deal with this threat. And you just wait till my State of the Union address, and I'm going to be discussing all of these issues. So I tuned in, and I listened attentively. And out of his 6,600-word State of the Union speech, only 108 words were dedicated to cybersecurity. Now, I get that the president's a busy man. He has ISIS and ISIL and lots of other things on his plate. But 108 words. And what was more troubling to me was the words that were used. Again, nonpartisan, just looking at this from a security perspective, was that he called for greater cooperation and information sharing. Okay, broadly a good idea. But he called for enhanced penalties for identity thieves. If you think that going ahead and increasing the sentence for an identity thief from 3 years to 6 years is going to solve the fundamental critical flaws in technology infrastructure of our country, you're just completely missing the boat. I wrote an op-ed on this piece, and I said, you know, claiming that enhanced penalties for identity thieves will protect us from a cybersecurity perspective is a little bit like putting on sunscreen and claiming it will protect you from a nuclear blast. It is wholly inadequate for the level of risk that we're facing. And so for America, as one of the most technologically advanced societies in the world, is every day we connect new and new things to the internet. It was our computer, then it was our phone, but now it's our cars, right? Average automobile, 250 electronic chips in it. They can be hacked remotely. Soon we'll have self-driving cars. That whole network, like any other computer, can be attacked. Pacemakers are connecting to the internet. Streetlights are connecting to the internet. Every physical device in our world is becoming a computer. So a car is not a mechanical device anymore. It's a computer that you ride in. An elevator is a computer that you ride in. An airplane is a Solaris box that you fly in, and a diabetic pump is a computer that you put into your body. And they're all hackable. There is no computer system that cannot be hacked. And so that's my biggest concern for America, is that we're building this future of our world, of our society, of our economic engine, built upon technology that we know to be fundamentally flawed, and yet we keep on plugging more and more things into the internet, which is why I subtitled my book Future Crimes, Everything is Connected, Everyone is Vulnerable, and What We Can Do About It, because I think we need to have a fundamental and radical reshift on our reliance upon technology, particularly when it can all come crashing down so easily.
What about the person, Mark, who says, you know, I don't care about this. I don't use drugs. You know, I check my bank account often, so if it gets hacked, I'm on it right away. I don't care about my privacy issues because I'm not doing anything wrong. What do you tell a person like that?
Well, those are a couple of different, you know, ways that people tend to ignore this problem. And, you know, it's kind of akin to going to the doctor's office, right? You go to the doctor's office and he can say, oh, you got to lose 50 pounds and you should stop smoking, you should stop drinking, right? Eventually the doctor wins that argument, you know, at the end of the day. And I think the same may be true here. Whether or not you do online banking, whether or not you have a credit card, whether or not you're a victim of identity theft, those are kind of the smaller problems, right? Your bank will make you whole. They'll send you a new credit card. You know, that's a problem, and it's an expensive one for society. The reason why you're paying, you know, 18 or 24% interest is because the banks pass all of those losses on to you. But for the more fundamental things that run society, if you want to get to work, if you want to get a paycheck, if you want to get clean water coming out of your faucet, then you better hope that those computer systems are reliable and resilient and will be there when you need them. So I think that's a challenge that people certainly, you know, even if you're non-technical, you need to be aware. With regards to privacy, you know, that's a complaint that I hear all the time. I've got nothing to hide. Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, was interviewed on CNBC by Maria Bartiromo. And she said to him, you know, what about Google and privacy and reading all our email? And his reply caught her off guard. He said, well, look, you know, if you're that concerned about privacy, maybe you shouldn't be doing things online that you don't want people to know about. And maybe some other people feel that way. But the fact of the matter is, we all value our privacy. We all value the right to be left alone. So, you know, Eric Schmidt may not care about privacy, But, you know, he has private moments with his wife when he goes to the bathroom. And you wouldn't want video of that projected on the Jumbotron at a Lakers game, right? We all have private moments in our lives. And then there are certain parts of the world where violations of your privacy can result in your death. So if you are a human rights activist or a member of Falun Gong or an opposition political party in certain parts of the world, the government is trying to break into your computer so that they can figure out who the bad guys are as they define them. You know, if you're gay in certain parts of the world, you'll get the death penalty in Iran for that. So keeping those types of communications private and secure are really important. And then plus we want to keep intimate moments of our life private. And it's under threat. It's under threat not just by government, but also by organized criminals and even large corporations who are taking your data and using it in ways that you don't realize. And I'll give you an example that I talk about in Future Crimes. There's a dating website called OkCupid, and it's free. And I warn people in the book that free can often be the most expensive price in the world. So, wow, great dating site, you know, I'll sign up. And when you go through the process of signing up, they ask you all of these questions like, how many sexual partners do you have? Do you like three ways? Do you use drugs? How often?
Whoa.
And if you're silly enough to click on the box and say, yes, I use cocaine 3 times a week. Why would somebody do that? Maybe they want to find somebody else who uses cocaine or marijuana because they want to date a person like that. What they didn't realize on this free website is that OkCupid was dropping hidden cookies on their computers that were identifying them as drug users, and they were selling that data to third parties, including employers and background investigation services. So here you are sharing information in one context, saying, yes, I like to smoke marijuana on the weekend. Yes, I drink more than 7 drinks a week. You're sharing this information in one context for the purpose of dating. You think only for dating. But when you signed up for the site, you know, there was that 10,000-word terms of agreement that nobody ever reads and you clicked on, and you gave them permission to share that data. And so they're taking your drug use, your alcohol abuse, your sexual history, and they're selling it to third parties. And so when you go and apply for that job and you magically don't get it, and you wonder, geez, I had a great interview. Why didn't I get it? It's because now they know that you're using drugs. They know that you have frequent sexual partners, maybe that you've had an abortion, whatever it may be. That data all leaks out, and people are making decisions about you and your life based upon that data.
What do you think of the new Samsung television that says they can see you?
That is a great example. So when I was growing up, and I suspect when you were growing up, televisions were mostly mechanical devices,
mm-hmm.
right? You went down to the TV store, you plugged it in, and it basically worked. But slowly, televisions, like all other physical objects, are becoming computers. And so now we don't have TVs, we have smart TVs. TVs that connect to the internet, and you get great services, right? You can stream
a zillion channels.
Netflix, yeah, Amazon, you get access to all of that stuff. You can even like check Facebook on your television. You know, some people like to do that.
Yep.
But now they've built in other features. So you can have a camera built into your television. So you can use your TV for Skype and have video conferencing. And one of the latest smart televisions that came out from Samsung has voice interactive commands. So the old way of changing the channel was very burdensome, and you could actually burn a billionth of a calorie if you had to sit there in your Barca lounger and push on the button. So they've gotten rid of all that exercise, and now you can just talk to your TV, so it's much more convenient. And that means that your TV is constantly listening for commands. So TV on, TV off, volume up, channel 7, channel 9.
Netflix, so, this, that, whatever.
Exactly. You can talk to your TV the same way you can talk to Siri. Well, now televisions, these smart televisions, actually comes with terms of service, conditions under which you agree to use the television. And you give Samsung the right to monitor what you watch and what you say. So Samsung just put out a notice that said, hey, attention people who own our smart TVs, just so you know, if you use a voice interactive command, we're going to be listening in the background all the time. So if you have anything sensitive that you want to say in your own home, in the privacy of your own bedroom,
in front of your TV,
please don't discuss it in front of your television, because we're recording all the time. We are taking that recording, we're sending it to third parties and doing voice recognition on it. So if you and your wife are in your bedroom discussing the most intimate details of your life, your television is listening. And if you've got a Samsung television in your boardroom and you're talking about your customers or your next quarterly strategy, your secret plans, your new product, your television is listening. So we are about to connect, depending on who you believe, anywhere from 50 billion, according to Cisco, or 200 billion, according to Intel Computers, 200 billion new devices to the internet by the year of 2020. By 2020, we'll have 200 billion new devices on the internet, and this is called the Internet of Things. So one of the mistakes people make when they think about technology is they look around, and compared to 20 years ago, it seems like we have so much tech. We have smartphones, and we've got Game Boys and Xboxes and GPS in our car, and it seems like there are computers everywhere. But what most folks don't get is that we are at the first minute of the first hour of the first days of the Internet revolution, and it's going to come about through the Internet of Things. Today's internet uses an addressing system. So the same way your telephone does, the same way you punch in a certain number and area codes, the phone company knows how to route your call, the same is true on the internet, and that's called the Internet Protocol Routing System, and today we use Internet Protocol version 4. But just as New York City and Los Angeles ran out of area codes and they need to split the city into smaller other area codes, the same has happened on the internet. The old internet, Internet Protocol version 4, could support 4.5 billion devices talking simultaneously on the net. But we've run out of space. And so in the next 3 years, we're going to switch to something called Internet Protocol version 6. And the number of connections will grow from 4.5 billion to 78 octillion. That is 78 billion, billion, billion simultaneous connections to this new internet that will be possible. So to put that, you know, what the hell is an octillion, right? Hard to figure out. But to put it in a metaphor that people will understand, today's internet is metaphorically the size of a golf ball, but tomorrow's will be the size of the sun. That means that every pet, plate, car, fork, pill bottle, everything is going online. And we can't even protect the stuff that we have online today. And we're adding, and we'll add, billions of new devices, which means that our threat surface area, the way by which people can attack us, is growing. So you don't just have to worry about your smartphone being hacked, but now it's your television, right? So somebody could turn on your television. People can turn on, in a hidden fashion, the camera on your smartphone or on your laptop, and you won't even see the light going on. David Petraeus, the former director of the CIA, when asked about the Internet of Things, said that their agency plans on fully exploiting on it. And he said, yeah, we're going to spy on people through their dishwashers. So governments are thinking about this. Criminals are certainly thinking about this. We're starting to see televisions being hacked and hackers going after those transactions, after those logons, because with some of these TVs you can buy things online. So your credit card information could be stored in your television. It certainly will be in the future.
Where do we get the book, Future Crimes, Mr. Goodman?
Future Crimes. You can pick it up at futurecrimes.com. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iBooks, any online or retailer, or at any shop.
And when you started doing this, did you ever think you'd get involved in it as big as you have?
Absolutely not. I told you in the past hour that, you know, I got involved in this because I knew how to spell check. And what kept me going is just a real interest in criminals and how they innovate and what they're up to. So I've just been pulling on a thread, and I see where these trends are going. William Gibson, who wrote the book Neuromancer, said the future has already arrived. It's just unevenly distributed. Even though many folks may not have heard of some of the things we've discussed tonight, that's happening. And I detail all of these stories in Future Crimes. There's lots of stuff going on that most people don't know about. And so I'm fascinated by it. I want people to have the information that they need to protect themselves. It used to say on the side of my police car, protect and serve. There's not too much protecting and serving going on in cyberspace. Most people are on their own. So the goal is, after discussing all this, not for people to feel afraid, but to feel empowered, to have the knowledge that they know, okay, there's bad things out there, and I need to take steps to protect myself.
Okay, we're going to come back and wrap things up with final calls on Coast to Coast AM when we come back, and that'll be an hour of you asking questions, or if you've been hacked, share those stories.